Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins, and we're really thrilled to have Dr. Tanya Zachrisson here today. And Dr. Zachrisson is a professor of trauma and acute care surgery and a member of the section of trauma and acute care surgery at the University of Chicago. She's the director of critical trauma research, which explores the connection between interpersonal trauma, critical race theory, and racial capitalism. And she's also the PI and program director of recovery legal care, which we'll be talking about later. Dr. Zachrisson attended medical school at the University of Toronto, where she completed her residency in general surgery. After a fellowship in adult critical care medicine at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, she spent a year at the Ryder Trauma Center, University of Miami, for her second fellowship year in trauma surgery. Following her fellowship years, Dr. Zachrisson completed a master's in public health from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health with coursework in Baltimore and Barcelona. Dr. Zachrisson was faculty at the University of Miami until joining the Department of Surgery at the University of Chicago in 2019. Since joining the faculty there, Dr. Zachrisson has been awarded the Department of Surgery Excellence in Teaching Award 2019 to 2020, and she's mentored numerous medical students, surgical residents, graduate students, and junior faculty to research excellence, presenting at national conferences and publishing peer-reviewed manuscripts on topics such as intimate partner homicide, homicides while incarcerated, the ethics of concurrent COVID-19 trials, penetrating brain injury, and other topics. There's a huge variety of topics. Dr. Zachrisson has been awarded a Buxbaum Institute pilot grant to develop a structural justice curriculum for trainees in trauma to improve patient care, reduce moral injury, and address the structural causes of intentional interpersonal trauma. So you're very, very welcome here today, and thank you so much, you know, for coming. You're obviously very busy and publishing amazing work, and we're really thrilled to have you.
Thank you so much.
You have an impressively broad range of research interests that span medical and surgical clinical research, as well as research focused on social determinants of health, critical race theory, racism, and diversity. So tell us what led you to your work today, as well as your broad range of research interests.
Thank you so much for inviting me to this phenomenal podcast. I really feel honored, and feel free to call me Tanya. For me, trauma and trauma surgery as a discipline was always interesting. I had this kind of morbid curiosity of when people get injured, what happens to them? How do you treat them? And even before medical school, for a summer, I actually worked as a paramedic for emergency medical services in the city of Toronto, which was a very rich and challenging experience. But it gives you a glance into how people live and how people exist and all the things that you don't necessarily appreciate when you're seeing a patient in the emergency department face to face. You don't see their environment and where they're coming from. But I want to take a step back even a few years prior to that. So, you know, I did my undergraduate training and the bulk of my medical training in Toronto, in Canada. And living in Toronto and growing up in the 1980s, 1990s, many of my friends and colleagues were coming from Central America, South America. They're fleeing a lot of right-wing dictatorships that, frankly, you know, our American government was funding, was supporting. And, you know, a lot of my friends had family members that were directly tortured, disappeared in El Salvador, or, you know, one that witnessed his father being assassinated in front of him for being a member of the Communist Party in Chile, for example, after Pinochet's coup d'etat. So all of these experiences and talking to people where, you know, here I am, like a Ukrainian, Swedish, Canadian kid going to undergrad, and my like biggest challenge of the day was getting up on time for my first period class or something like that, or where am I going to find coffee or whatever. Like very kind of mundane, privileged white people challenges of the day. And I'm hearing stories of, you know, from friends that were like, yeah, I had a revolutionary poem in my pocket when I was in engineering school at the university, and the military came in San Salvador and arrested my professor, and I had to tear up the poem and swallow the pieces, or else I would have been disappeared as well. Like all these stories. And not in the sense of like, wow, such poor people, that's so terrible, I'm so lucky that I get to live this way in Toronto and I can escape all that. It's like, huh, what is the connection to how they're living, to how I'm living? And that's so important, because we were pouring in like up to around $1 million a day during the time of Ronald Reagan into El Salvador, for example, and 5% of the population were killed. So that planted the seed of like, huh, you know what? There's so much injustice locally, nationally, continentally, and globally. What will my role be in fighting this injustice? Because I really, you know, you can't not feel that when it's, you know, these people that are close to you explaining what their lives have been and their dedication also to these social movements. And I think, you know, I was always concerned, this is getting deep down a rabbit hole, Amelia, so you can cut me off if I'm going too far. But I was always concerned that, you know what, I'm worried that, you know, when things come to a head and people, you know, are exhausted by seeing rich, privileged classes and billionaires get their way. Huh, funny how this all rings so true today. And usurp democratic movements or thwart election results, because if it's the popular candidate that wins on behalf of the that want to, you know, promote programs that help poor populations, for example, and they're usurped or they're disappeared or they're removed from that position and the oligarchs take over once again, you know, people tend to have no other way of changing that system other than after, you know, trying over and over again, then they say, well, I have to pick up arms. So that was like, and choose a violent pathway. And that was not uncommon in the 1980s, 1990s as like the only pathway. Personally, for myself, it was like, I can't go down and join a revolutionary movement or a guerrilla movement. And also I've never really, you know, this is idealistic. And again, comes from a position of privilege. Like I don't feel violence is the answer in any situation. Although I have seen situations where it fully makes sense why people would choose violence. That's not for me, but I figured when things do come to a head and people say enough is enough, and what is going on with this whole system of like basically racialized and genderized capitalism that we have globally imposed on us, even though many people around the world don't think it's actually the best for planet Earth or the human beings and animals on planet Earth. My role could be a different role. My role could be that of a healer. And I could be helping the people on the side of, hey, we need something better for not just my family and my kids, but for our community or the collective as a whole, so that we can help each other develop, like, A, live as human beings, which is something that we still struggle with on the south side of Chicago. Many people aren't even afforded the dignity of humanity. But we want to move beyond that and help everyone develop their human potential so we can all benefit from that collective genius that we have inside. So that's a very complicated and far too detailed background for like trauma surgery is interesting to me. A, because I love the blood and guts. I'm not going to lie about that. And that's part of the reason why I'm in the United States and not in Canada, because we have too many social programs, social systems. We don't really see the trauma, and especially the violent trauma that you do in the United States. But then more importantly, it gave me not just permission, it's part of my job description to ask about the causes of the causes. why am I seeing this 12-year-old come in with a gunshot wound to their head, right? How is this normal in any country on earth? And in most countries, it's not normal. Here, it maybe might make the local news, but we've normalized the abnormal so much that it speaks to a broader national pathology that as a trauma surgeon, it is literally my job to unpack that, you know, with the idea of injury prevention, but also I would go further, not just the absence of violence and the reduction or elimination of injury, but to the key root cause of how do we develop our collective human potential.
Well, I love the way you're kind of thinking so broadly and also thinking about racism and gun violence, because those are two of the topics that we've been trying to, you know, discuss on our podcast. And I love the way you can focus on, you know, medical stuff, but also all of the social things that, you know, that are so impactful as well. So you did mention structural violence, and you wrote an amazing article about this. It's called Social Violence, Structural Violence, Hate and the Trauma Surgeon. And that was almost like a sort of social sciences type of paper, where you brought in a lot of ideas about cultural violence and structural violence. So can you just talk a little bit more about those ideas and how these sort of triangulate together to you know, cause direct violence in some communities?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you for that question. And all the credit goes to Johan Galtung, who is a Norwegian mathematician and sociologist, because that combination is, I guess, common in the Scandinavian countries where I have roots. But, you know, in 1969, he wrote an article about structural violence. And I think for me and for many of my colleagues, we were struggling with the nomenclature and the language of what do we call this violence that we're witnessing every day and every night in our trauma bays. Why is it people who do not look like me, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, quite tall woman, I am not the phenotype that comes into the trauma bay shot day and night. Why is that, you know? And so how do you call those structures of not just harm, but structures of death, of premature mortality, of death, of injury that are existing in our country? And it's interesting because the structural violence, if you think about it, it's any sort of type of discrimination. And of course, you know, racial capitalism, which our country is founded on, is like the bedrock of everything that I even see today or tonight on call. Like it's still very, very persistent and prevalent. But it can be gender discrimination. It can be, you know, transphobia, it can be ageism, any sort of barriers to developing, again, that human potential is a form of violence. Now, this isn't the violence that will like kill you right now, but it's a slow violence and it leads to a slow death, if you think about it. What's interesting, and again, I'm literally just amplifying Galtung's work. You have structural violence in the one side, the one apex of a triangle, if you think of an equilateral triangle. And then on the other side, you have cultural violence, which are all the institutions in society that normalize the structural violence. I'll give you both an example. So you might even remember yourself, or you might have family members that you saw this with, but there's a point where as a child, you might see someone who's unhoused on the street. They're maybe sleeping on the street. You know, this is certainly a problem in Toronto, especially during winter. And as a child, you might ask, or you might see a child ask their parent or whoever they're with, why is that person sleeping outside? Like, why don't they go home? And then they're told they don't have a home. And that's kind of devastating for the child to learn. Like, why? What kind of society would let someone live on the street like that and be so rejected and alienated and all the things? there comes a time then after that initial experience as a child where now we're an older child or maybe a preteen, we're an adolescent and adult. And now, sadly, I can go to my local Whole Foods, you know, and pass by, you know, our migrant family from Venezuela or something who is so precariously housed, if at all, that, but I'm so used to the messaging over the years of living in North America of, well, it's their choice. They kind of failed economically themselves. They're probably addicted to drugs and alcohol. Like, there's subtle and sometimes not so subtle messaging that we get from TV, from school and formal education. Sometimes it's from religious institutions or cultural institutions where this messaging leads me to the conclusion that it's kind of their own fault. Whatever happens and whatever that process is, I can walk by an unhoused family and not think twice about it. That initial pain I felt as a child of, wow, there's a child that's living on the street too. That pain, that psychic kind of destruction of how can we let humans live this way is not felt anymore. And not just because I'm older, but because I've been conditioned to not feel that way. So getting back to the model, you have structural violence on the one hand, the layers of discrimination, whether it's class-based or anything, that leads to that marginalization. And it's preventable. It's completely avoidable. It's like a political decision. There's a whole bunch of reasons why, but it doesn't have to be that way. Then you have that cultural violence where, you know, Palestinians just aren't as equal to, you know, Israelis, let's just say. Something goes on year after year that conditions the mind. Then both of those will lead to the top and the apex of your equilateral triangle to direct violence. Like those structures, the interplay of both leads to harm. And that's what, you know, in the world of trauma, we'll call preventable morbidity and mortality. But it leads to, for example, in the United States, 74,000 excess deaths of African Americans every year in this country, which is definitionally a genocide. And within white academic circles, it's not being spoken about. And this is, again, not new today. This has gone on for like a good 400 years. And even before that, we had our Indigenous or Native American population here in the United States or First Nations in Canada. It's the same thing. But the fact that they're up north, I know they have no water and it's been a water emergency and their life expectancy is 20 years less than the white populations down in Toronto or in the cities. The fact that it's out of sight, out of mind somehow, that's that cultural violence, acknowledging the structural violence subconsciously, but they still die prematurely. I did want to mention one thing with that paper that I think is important to mention, which is sort of more of an organic kind of idea that I had with my co-author, who's also my husband, Davo Milian Valdez, who's a surgeon down in Havana, and where we're really based the majority of the time, is the concept of hate. And hate as a public health disease, if you think about it, because if you have like a neonate, like a newborn baby, they grow up, no one is born hating the way no one is born already with malaria. Although I take that back, that actually there might be maternal transplacental crossing. Let's just say for argument's sake, no one is born with like infectious disease X, right? Let's call it malaria for the argument sake. And I'll just say I'm just a surgeon, so I'll pull that aside. So no one is born hating. Hate is something that someone learns throughout their life. They learn to hate. And that's because you have an adult who already has the disease of hate. And that's well established. And we can say a lot of the rhetoric we're hearing nowadays under the new regime. But the spread of hate is through hate speech and this dialogue of hate, that information of hate through, again, cultural violence. But there's a vector where the words are the vector and they carry that disease of hate through hate speech, much in the way that an adult might have malaria. Again, you need the mosquito to get the malaria from the adult, and the mosquito will transfer the malaria parasite into the the baby or the child, and that's how you get malaria. So I think, you know, it's important where we talk about like disrupting these cycles of hate is really important. And that's only done, in my humble opinion, through really understanding your history and why you're here where you are today. But I think it is something that can be disrupted. And we've seen that, you know, I always say this, and I'm dual Canadian American citizenship, but culturally, you know, much more Canadian, having been born and raised there. It's so fascinating to me in the United States, because there's some Americans that have like very strong views that do have notions of excluding populations and being discriminatory against people, and maybe have not had the opportunity to leave the United States or even leave their state or county, or for a variety of reasons, and you know, much of which is economic. But for a country that has so much strong messaging of like Super Bowl is number one, that should be your main concern. No, you know, yay Super Bowl. I'm not denigrating that, but the messaging, I think of this every time I put on cable TV when I'm on call in the call room. The messaging is so strong to be so individualistic, to be so kind of non-cooperative, that what's beautiful to me about this country is you still have millions of people, I mean, such as yourselves, although Amelia, I think you grew up elsewhere, but so many people in the United States that are like, I'm going to resist that. I'm going to read books. I'm going to learn other things. I'm going to travel the world. I'm going to push back against what that cultural violence is being like, what people are trying to teach me, which is cultural violence. I'm going to push back against this narrative that it's like dog eat dog. I'm not going to know my neighbor, versus one of like, hey, let's try to build solidarity, bridges of solidarity. Let's try to build bridges of community. And we see the beautiful work, again, being done in Chicago on the South Side, where unfortunately you hear the negative stories, but there's beautiful stories of entire communities pushing back and creating their own collectives of resistance, love, joy, and power. And that's phenomenal to me. I mean, it's easy for us as Canadians to be liberal because that's kind of like our national shtick, right? You know, we love multiculturalism and all these good things. In the United States, it's not so easy because that's not the mainstream messaging. If you just turn on CNN or Fox News, right? So I think it's a beautiful, beautiful thing here. Like you truly have a revolutionary people in this country and other people that need to be cognizant of that cycle of hate then does need interrupting.
Yes, no, I completely agree with you. I grew up in Ireland, so it's a very, very different approach, I would say. This is all just amazing and fascinating, and I'd love to delve more into that article. But I also want to touch on your article about the cost of firearm injuries and readmission, which is really interesting. And all of these articles will be posted on our website if people are interested in looking at them. But first of all, like, the fact you were able to do this work and find that data and report it was, you know, so impressive, but also actually the results obviously are very, very concerning. So can you tell us a bit more about that work?
Sure. And, you know, I think for that work, I really have to give a solid, solid shout out to the primary author and lead of this work, Dr. Rishi Rattan, who's also a trauma surgeon right now working in Portland. And he is a brilliant, brilliant human being and an incredible human being and trauma surgeon. And he's sort of that model that I aspire to of understanding and looking at the causes of the causes and, you know, dealing with things within context. So in all honesty, that was largely his idea. So he led that effort. But it was interesting because this is how, again, another example of cultural violence. I used to think, just to take a brief step back, Amelia, for a second, I used to think all we have to do is count the number of people who have been shot in this country, and we will collectively be horrified by those numbers. And then politicians will spring into action, and they're going to do something about this, like, horrifying reality, you know. in addition to, you know, like the disproportionate number of African Americans who are affected, Latinos or Latinx community members that are affected, rural people, you know, the amount of like suicide in and older white men in rural communities, like people are going to take action because it's like horrifying and uniquely American. That is not the case. And it took me a bit of time to learn that. And so we're moving into the sphere of, well, if we can't use the moral argument, let's say, of like, maybe humans shouldn't die prematurely, then let's look at like, well, how much is this costing society? It's like, again, how do we appeal to politicians? Oh, we'll show that they're losing money, which is in and of itself a really sad statement of where, like, what sphere do we need to do research in, you know? But I would argue that all data is equally important, even though we're moving towards a model of, you know, measuring disparities in healthcare, reducing disparities in healthcare, eliminating disparities in healthcare, but we're trying to move now to healing disparities in healthcare using reparations as a public health approach, which we could talk about later. This paper was very interesting because it was something so brilliant that Rishi did, because normally we look at how much does it cost if you come into the hospital and you're shot. And it's like, of course, millions of dollars across the country, if not billions. But he said, well, is there more to this story? And you know, more to that story might be, well, maybe people come back with complications, they have to be treated. But Rishi was like, yeah, that's true. And we can look within our own hospital databases and say, oh, this patient was discharged, but then they came back like a week later and they spent an extra week in hospital. So let's measure all of that time. He was like, well, he literally just asked the question, what if they go somewhere else? What if they're like, huh, I went to hospital X and I clearly had a complication and I'm not happy with the care they gave me because of this complication or for other reasons, I'm going to go to hospital Y. And so how often does that happen? How much does that cost? So we're lucky to use the National Readmissions Database that actually can capture those data of where people are going, if it's to a second hospital, a different hospital. And it was, he uncovered that there's like millions more being spent on these patients, because I think it was like 7.6% were readmitted. And then 1 in 6 of those patients were readmitted to different hospitals. So it's not like a 1 in 1,000 event that's occurring. This is commonplace. And no one had captured that financial impact prior to when Rishi started to ask the question. So it's even larger than we had previously anticipated in terms of the cost to society, because the bulk and the brunt of the cost is paid by the public sector.
Yeah, that was very, very interesting that it's paid for by the public sector. Now, I know Kirk probably has loads of questions he wants to ask, but just before I hand it over to him, I wanted to ask about the Recovery Legal Care Program that you started. I think it was last year. So we did have someone called Lynette Martins on our show, I think a couple of seasons ago, talking about medical legal partnerships. And this sounds a little like that, but can you tell us what's the purpose and how this all came about? This is just amazing work.
Oh, thank you so much. And Amelia, I think I was remiss on not maybe updating my bio, but we've been lucky because Recovery Legal Care has been around now since, I want to say, 2022. And you're right that we've been able and fortunate to get funding to start this program. And this is an endeavor I'm doing with my co-PI, Dr. Elizabeth Tung, who does primary care medicine, internal medicine, and as well as a social epidemiologist. We're also doing this with Dr. Franklin Cozy Gay, who's at the time in charge of our violence recovery program at the hospital, and also Dr. Selwyn Rogers, who is the head of our trauma center here at the University of Chicago. So it is a medical legal partnership, which means you bring civil law attorneys or legal aid attorneys into the medical space, because people are realizing that patients of all types and backgrounds have what we call health-harming legal needs. This might be akin to like a social determinant of health, if you will, in the sense that maybe someone is recovering from their illness or injury, but maybe they have insecure housing. Maybe they're worried about getting evicted. Maybe they actually don't have appropriate access to food or nutritional support. Maybe they need crime victim compensation after firearm injury, for example. So, you know, we learned that these health-harming legal needs are these, what we also, and I like to call these structural determinants of health, are more important for our patients. After we started interviewing our patients, many of whom were affected, the majority of whom were affected by firearm injury, and we said, hey, how can, and this was amazing work done by Dr. Stephanie Washington, our medical student who's now going to become a urologist, and she asked our trauma patients, how can we support you after discharge? Once you go home after your gunshot wound, how can we best support you? Do you need spiritual care, mental health care? What do you need? And she measured and found that actually the majority, like 70% plus of our patients, once they were discharged, actually were scoring positive for post-traumatic stress disorder. But what was fascinating is our patients were like, Stephanie, I know I have post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, and I'd love to sit down and talk to a psychiatrist or a mental health expert for therapy. But if I don't know how I'm going to feed my children tonight, I don't care about any of that. Like, I can't afford to care about any of that. If I'm worried that we're going to be evicted because I just lost my job, even though that's illegal, but because I've been hospitalized and I can't go back to work because I was shot in the arm and I need my arm for work, that's what I care about, not how do I feel with my feelings, even though they acknowledge like that is important. They just weren't able to engage in healing on their level because of these structural determinants of health. So health-harming legal needs takes those structural determinants of health. They're more focused into, you know, income, housing, even, you know, legal support for folks who might be without documents and whatnot. It's these public benefits. What do people need to get back on their feet? So this is the first medical legal partnership that we've created in a trauma center that is fused and harmonized with our hospital-based violence intervention program, which, as I mentioned earlier, is called for us our violence recovery program. And that's very novel. In fact, that we haven't really seen that in the country except for sort of some centers are starting to do that and doing that on a smaller level. But we're very excited because we've been able to get Legal Aid Chicago public benefits attorneys and legal aid attorneys to go into the hospital, go to the bedside of people who have been shot, injured, assaulted, to say, hey, I'm your free attorney, and how can I help you with your health-harming legal needs? And we're right now at the stage, because we're able to get, you know, funding from a couple of federal agencies, we're at the stage now where we're measuring to see, does this impact our patients? Does it reduce the risk of re-injury by firearm violence? Does it help actually family members? How does it help in terms of psychometric measures or mental health measures or a whole variety of things? And we're doing this in conjunction with other centers across the country through an NIH-funded project that we're very excited about. And I think it speaks to the power of having a lawyer on your side, because you'd be surprised at how much they're able to do just by talking to the bureaucracy for X, Y, or Z, and on the other end of the phone, having someone say, well, we're not going to accept the application because the ink color was wrong. And then having our attorney say, okay, that's fine. By the way, I'm an attorney and I'm happy to see you in court where we can resolve the matter, or I'm simplifying it a bit. And then all of a sudden the ink color is not a problem. So it's, you know, the way one of our original attorney said, it's like having a social worker with teeth, able to move the system. Moving beyond that, though, what really inspires us, I think, as well, is not just plugging the public benefit gaps of society where we already know our African-American communities are getting less and less public benefits and probably even less after the next like month to year to 4 years. Our Latino communities, again, are being denied benefits compared to the 1990s, for example. We don't want to have lawyers fighting for their public benefits because we in fact feel that the legal entitlements that these people are due and they're not getting prior to injury are indeed the risk factor for the injury in the first place. But we want to hold the government accountable to say, like, why aren't my patients getting, nutritional support when it's their legal right to get it prior to getting shot? They shouldn't have to get shot to realize like, oh, only 16% of the patients that present are getting shot or rather have the public benefits that they deserve. So we want to figure out ways, how do we hold the government accountable? Like, do we bring them to court? Do we do a writ of mandamus, which is a mechanism where you can say, people need crime victim compensation, not 18 months after the injury. They need it 1 month after the injury, and we need to expedite what is their legal right. You know, it's interesting, the tax credits. And if you think about all the kind of income tax and tax benefits that people like me get when you're in the upper class, the 1% and whatnot, it's so easy for us to get those. And we get them as almost a matter of fact. When someone needs food support, they have to fight to get and to maintain it because it disappeared. For example, we'll have a patient where they will be receiving SNAP benefits for 6 months, and then all of a sudden it'll disappear. And then our attorney has to look into why. And then some notice arrived by snail mail to our patient's address, which was like three addresses ago, saying, by the way, you have to do these nonsensical things to maintain your SNAP benefits. And if you don't, you'll lose it. Like the whole system is kind of ridiculous. We had another patient who was sadly shot by her intimate partner when she was pregnant, causing disability in her newborn baby and in herself. She was on Medicaid, which spontaneously became suspended because the state government figured that she had moved to Indiana based on no evidence. So they just stopped funding her Medicaid. So we needed an attorney to help sort of organize that because I can barely negotiate the system and I'm a pretty well-trained surgeon. It's far more complex than anything I ever had to deal with in Canada, and on purpose, because the people that are harmed through the layers of bureaucracy and denials and all that, it's not the 1%, it's my patients. And I don't even remember what question you originally asked me, Amelia. So I apologize for that. But yes, our medical legal partnership, Recovery Legal Care, I think is a very novel tool to really say, hey, there are upstream drivers of this harm in the first place. But also, how are we going to hold the government accountable to say you have to fix the gaps in society? And the book Poverty by America by Matthew Desmond is really eye-opening. It was very eye-opening for me to see the public benefits economy and how it's working for some and not working for a lot more.
Yeah, wow. A lot of different things you've touched on in your responses. And I guess this is dating the podcast, whenever our listeners are listening to this. But of course, you talked about the Super Bowl, and I'm going to just mention the halftime show with, of course, rapper Pulitzer Prize winning, Grammy Award winning Kendrick Lamar, and the performative protest that he demonstrated in so many different ways. And that is deeply connected to your work, looking at, structural hate, structural oppression in many different forms and facets. And when I was listening to your responses to my colleague, Dr. Barwise. So many questions have come into mind. One particular question that is rooted in actually my research now regarding victim service hospitals. Really don't talk about my research on our podcast, but because what you're talking about is so connected to it, there's only 258 victim service hospitals in the country, with thousands of hospitals overall, which is about 3%. And what's interesting, I came across, and I would like to hear your thoughts about this. In 1996, there was an amendment passed called the Dickey Amendment. I don't know if you ever heard of that, but the Dickey Amendment prohibits use of federal funds to advocate, promote, and research gun control. And I know over the past few years, I believe in 2021, there has been provisions that, through the CDC to fund, I don't know the percentage, but to fund or to start funding research regarding gun violence. But obviously there's so many legal obstacles and hoops to jump over. It's really hard to gather the particular data that you talked about, but also how we could affect, positively impact patients of gun violence after, you know, the physical wounds heal, right? They still have, of course, the mental, social, and many other different wounds to try to mend after that, you know, horrific experience. So my question is, what, in the spirit of protest, right, talking about, what do you think doctors and healthcare professionals can do to really bring awareness to this issue? Because, of course, gun violence, that is, if not the biggest, one of the biggest health issues, but also social issues as well in our country.
Well, Kirk, thank you so much for that question. And I will start by inviting Liz to interview you and Amelia, because I would love to hear a podcast on your research and all the amazing things that you do when you're not doing these phenomenal podcasts. Or maybe I'll interview you. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, here's a breaking news. We will have a founders podcast. So the four individuals, Dr. Amelia Barwise, Dr. Elizabeth Truong, Dr. Nicole Strand, and myself, we will do a founder series about our own research. And a lot of people ask, because we always interview folks and folks are like, what do you do? What are your areas of specialty? So that is coming. That's coming soon. Fantastic. So just to make you aware.
And then also, I can't let the Super Bowl halftime show slide either. Coming from Toronto, you know, it's interesting. It's, yeah, I think we have to say we're Drake fans or else we get our citizenship revoked. But, but you know, seeing Kendrick Lamar there, and also it's a very heavy sort of American culturalized show. And I don't know if, Amelia, the same thing happened with you. I needed to read a lot to understand a lot of the symbolism. But it struck such a chord with, like, even the Gil Scott Heron references to the revolution will not be televised and it will be televised. That just the brilliant, that's kind of what I was sort of alluding to earlier, that brilliance of how can Kendrick Lamar, Pulitzer Prize winning Kendrick Lamar, free his mind so much with so much external messaging saying you shouldn't think that way. You're not allowed to think that way. We will punish you, just like Uncle Sam was saying, for thinking that way and acting and performing that way. So it was a stroke of genius that I feel I've only understood the periphery of the genius, you know, that it was. So sorry, Drake. I don't know what to tell him. But more seriously to your question, so you're absolutely correct. The Dickey Amendment came out in large response to a 1994 New England Journal of Medicine paper by Arthur Kellerman, that demonstrated that if you have firearms in your home, your risk of death increases from either suicide or homicide. It basically demonstrated, in a very well-designed study also, that your chance of death goes up. Guns in the home do not make you safer. It leads to death. Like, you know, like I said, homicide, suicide, intimate partner violence, it is unsafe to have guns in the home. So the Dickey Amendment was like, uh-oh, that's going to be bad for gun sales. So let's, you know, clamp down on all that research. You know, my personal experience at the University of Miami is when I started wanting to just count the number of people coming in who were shot at the Ryder Trauma Center, I was told no by the Institutional Review Board, which is our board where we have to ask permission to do research. Your listeners might probably be familiar with the concept. So I appealed. They said no again. I appealed another time. And points for honesty, they basically came out and said, Tanya, we can't let you do this study, even though you're not making any political statement. You're just counting the number of gunshot wounds and injuries because we're worried we're going to lose our funding from Tallahassee for Jackson Memorial Hospital, a public hospital. And it was very interesting because I'd never been in a situation even globally, and I've done research and work around the world in many different countries. I've never been in a situation where someone was telling me as a scientist I wasn't allowed to ask a question about a certain topic. And that seemed pretty Orwellian. And kind of very strange, especially for a country that touts itself as being, you know, the bastion of freedom of expression, the way we tout ourselves as being the freest country on earth when we're the most incarcerated country on earth. It's the opposite. We're actually the most unfree country on earth. So doing research in that area is hard. And the irony is nowadays, the number one cause of death of children and adolescents, as you both know, is firearm injury. Now, that was the number one cause of death of Black kids for many, many years. But, you know, as a society, we responded when it was like all kids, not just Black kids. But it's been a problem in this country for a very long time. And my concern, and in fact, I think it's quite a real concern, is that our current government is saying that they're going to clamp down on research dollars available for gun control, gun violence research and whatnot, even though thanks to the funding made available from the Biden administration, we have actually seen a significant decline in firearm injury over the past year for everyone, for all people. And in fact, it's like the most impactful decline we've ever seen in this country. So that those research and those community violence intervention dollars really make a difference. My fear is that's going to disappear on us. Now, how do we study this? How do we get to the bottom of it? You know, it's an interesting question because I don't know if we really need to count how many people get shot again, as I mentioned earlier. Like, we already know this is a problem. In fact, not just with firearm violence, but I think to really get into the nitty gritty, what's concerning to me is the fact that we monetize harm in this country. So, you know, firearm violence, like the only time the National Rifle Association fought in favor of gun control was when the Black Panther Party in California entered the legislature with their open carry guns, which was legal at the time to say, hey, we're going to exercise our constitutional right too. That freaked out a bunch of white lawmakers and they said, no, let's do gun control. And the NRA as well. I worry that there's a $21 billion a year motivation to have a wide range of firearms available for sale. And sales certainly went up during COVID. I worry there's financial gain to mass incarceration where we can fill up our super prisons that might be privately run and with lobbying groups like ALEC that fight for them to be open and full at all times, whether people are, you know, committing crimes or not, but the profit comes from filling them. I worry about the profit generated from using incarcerated human beings as slaves to fight forest fires in California, to do anything that is basically asked of them for no remuneration or very little remuneration. And should they say no, they run the risk of solitary confinement and a whole bunch of other negative repercussions. I worry that fast food, we monetize fast food, and even though the ultra processed food we know is extremely harmful for all of us, for children. We monetize disease in this country. That was another mind-blowing thing coming here as a physician, is really there's no money, if you will, to be made in preventive healthcare. It's the disease that makes the money because of the way the system is created. There is money to be made in wars. Wow, do we love like when countries invade and we give, you know, Ukraine or Israel like bombs and guns and all that? Because like, what a brilliant way to take taxpayer billions of dollars and give it to our then own weapons manufacturers. 90% of the aid given to Ukraine to fight the war on Russia stayed in the United States because we just went from the public to the private. And then those private CEOs say, hey, thanks, leader in charge. We'll make sure we keep lobbying you and funding your campaigns. That's a bit of a cynical view, but I think all of that has to be flipped around. And how do you do that is, I think it's a very, very deep and important conversation. One that many Americans have been having about what is more important. Like, you know, should healthcare be a human right or a market commodity? What is more important, like the value of a human being's life or profit, you know, and that this is coming up in so many circles. But it's a fundamental thing and it's hard to undo because if you think about where this country came from, and Canada isn't that much different, right? We're a settler colonialist, you know, project, both in Canada and the United States, where, you know, white people came here and they stole the land and then they stole humans to come and forcibly work the land, you know, so like the economic generation of wealth in this country, the roots of that economic generation of wealth are extremely troubling. I'll whitewash it, no pun intended, in that fashion, that to one day wake up and dissociate ourselves from that, again, racial exploitation is something that needs like a deep conversation and a deep approach on a like a political and a national level, I would argue. I mean, it's the same thing with Canada too, but it's very deep to consider that. So firearm violence, getting back to your question, Kirk, is all wrapped in into that. And I think it's important for us to, again, speak to people who have been injured by firearm injury, speak to families who have lost people or live with people who have been injured, speak to community organizations that are doing the work. So a quick and dirty thing anyone can do, even if you're not working with people who are injured by firearm injury or anything, is always talk to your patients, talk to the people affected by that injury. And also, we have a group called Praxis, Practicing Radical Action by Expanding Inclusive Societies, but where we move from research to action. And before we do anything in the research field, we want to know what our community friends think about it. What do our community members think about it? You know, we work closely with organizations like Southside Together or the Woodlawn Restorative Justice Hub, and they really help a lot of young people who've been affected by violence heal through the process of either having been shot or shooting as well, through restorative and reparative kind of approaches. And they teach us, like they teach us, no, this research is not useful or this is. We did a project with Chicago Cred with some of our colleagues from Praxis, where it was the female violence interventionists that were saying, hey, we'd like to know, like, what is it like to hear our female perspective and working in this space? Like, what are the unique strengths that we bring to it? What are some vulnerabilities or some additional challenges we deal with? And it was so fascinating and eye-opening, and they did a phenomenal job, and we were kind of just the levers in the machinery to help them get that going, to show that the amount of disclosure of like history of childhood molestation or previous trauma or other things that their male counterparts weren't getting is really important to learn how to help you know, their clients, if you will, heal. And it was just eye-opening, and also how to support them in their role. So I am rambling at this point. And I apologize for that.
No, this is good stuff. You've dropped a lot of gems, and we had, as we do in every podcast, have a set amount of questions, but you dropped so many gems. We weren't really obviously dedicated to those questions. We wanted to dive in more. I wish we could have a part two of our conversation here, but so no, that's perfectly fine. I will ask one question, and hopefully we'll have a part two, because you unpacked a lot of intricacies that are interconnected regarding social violence, but also structural violence as well. So of course we have, and you referred to the current administration now and the shifts that are happening on so many levels, on the micro, but also the macro level in our country, but also in our society, in the global society. I will ask you, what can the health and medicine community do to try to, again, to the best of their ability, to quell the social violence and structural violence for, of course, people of color, the queer community, particularly trans, which obviously, if you've read the headlines, they are being heavily impacted by different decisions, but also women as well. You know, these particular demographics that have historically been marginalized and oppressed in society. What, I guess this is kind of like a rephrasing of the protest question, but what can we do? Because again, these demographics are hurting. They already were hurting, you know, prior to the administration that we have currently. But because of the intentional choices, legislatively, choices that are being revoked or reversed, it's going to even cause more harm, more social and structural harm to these communities. So I'm just curious, what can we do, basically, as academics, as people that work in clinical medicine, healthcare medicine overall?
So thank you, Kirk. That's a great question. And, you know, just to highlight one example of what you mentioned, like the harm against women and the loss of abortion rights, you know, just to give your listeners an idea of how this has ramifications throughout the entire structure of society. You know, training programs in OBGYN or obstetrics and gynecology are now in certain states and a lot of the red states having a hard time recruiting fellows, recruiting trainees, residents into these programs. Because in order to have a training program in obstetrics and gynecology, you need to be able to perform competently complex abortions and pregnancy interruptions, complex abortions. There's a whole, you know, surgical science behind that. If you can't do that, you don't meet the requirements for being a residency program, and that program shuts down. In addition to having faculty members who do perform those procedures being told, oh, you can't perform these procedures anymore, saying, well, then I'll just move north and work there where I'm legally allowed to perform these procedures and come to places like Illinois. So what happens when an OBGYN residency program shuts down? So it creates a complete care desert in the area. But one thing that in one of our papers, Amelia, I don't know if we have it, but one of our medical students actually looked at this. One of the repercussions is if a hospital loses, if a teaching hospital loses their OBGYN program, and if that teaching hospital is also a trauma center, like here, like the University of Chicago, like a level 1 trauma center, if I want to be accredited as a trauma center, I have to demonstrate that I have OBGYN care 24/7 available for my pregnant trauma patients. If I don't have that, my trauma center will shut down or will not have the accreditation I need for the verification standards. I will fail in meeting them. And that's actually going to impact men's health as well. Like, it's just, we don't even know. I mean, the fact you know, barring young folk from getting gender reassignment and gender reaffirmation surgery when they have gender dysmorphia, ending that option, for example, will increase the risk of suicide in young people. Like, the impact of these policies is death. Now, is this the first time that we're seeing discrimination writ large, you know, across the United States? Hell no. And Kirk, you know, like, you tell me, but like, this is nothing new. Unfortunately, we have a legacy of like structural racism, discrimination for so long, but what can we do? So I think one thing is people like me, all of us actually in our institutions, we hold power, and you don't actually have to be in an institution to hold power. And we have more power together when we connect with each other. And we have power to use our letterheads, our titles. You know, University of Chicago has a fancy bird on a crest that looks all very Ivy League-ish and stuff. But we can use our power to, for example, something we're planning to do through Praxis is to approach the governor, the attorney general with whom we have relationships, the mayor's office, to say, hey, our community partners are worried about losing their jobs because their funding is actually, even though it is via the state, is actually federal. And federal funding for firearm violence intervention is being put on hold or is under threat. Like, our friends and colleagues are worried about their salary lines. You know, I might be saddened about, oh, can I do this research or that? I'm going to still eat at the end of the day, whereas my friends might not be able to. So how do we leverage our power to go to people in charge and say, hey, what's our plan B? What are we going to do to support these people that have demonstrated an impact in community violence nationwide? That's one thing. The other thing is, and you know, I guard against a bit of performative things, but even things of like pronouns on your badges as like professors of surgery, or showing that there are indeed like safe spaces for people, you know, in their hospitals, in their environments, for our trainees, for example, that's really important. But again, you know, some concept that's been very fascinating for me was something I learned from my friend Astra Taylor, who is very big in the Occupy movement and also is part of the debtcollective.org, where it's people that have medical debt or carceral debt, or I mean, so many different forms of financial debt, where they formed a union of debtors. And that creates so much power. And you might think like, well, what can these people do together because they're so economically precarious? But if you come together, you get legal solutions, or you all say, we're going to default on this, or we're going to do something about this. We're going to become debt abolitionists together. I think that's something we should do in the medical field. How do we unionize our survivors of firearm violence, if you will? How do we bring people together? And I don't have the easy, quick and dirty solution, but we can follow models like that to say, wow, we're talking about, this is like 45,000 people a year. Now, granted, there's like a big chunk of that, 2/3 that are related to suicide, but you're talking about hundreds of thousands to millions of people in this country that have been affected by firearm violence. You know, that's a lot of power together, but it's building solidarity and fighting against that messaging of cultural violence that says you're on your own, go get your gun, be afraid of everyone around you, especially if they're not white, you know, and fight for only yourself and your immediate family, versus like, hey, let me check on my neighbor, see how they're doing. And one very pragmatic thing that we've been turning to in our academic circles, if you will, is learning from people who have been doing this for a long time. And so we've actually been tuning in to the podcast, Practicing Radicals. No, it's not practicing. It's, oh my goodness, I have to think about this. And this is a textbook too, but it's interesting because it's a couple of people, one who is within the academic sphere and the other who is like a community organizer. And it's really, really interesting because it's actually called Practical Radicals. They talk about what can we learn from the past that has worked. And in particular, what can we learn from the genius of the civil rights movement? And these are people that, I mean, like, such brave people. And we're talking about like the KKK running around, you know, they're still there today, like taking risk in their own hands where their lives on a daily basis are under threat. And having, you know, like a minister, for example, calculate how many Black people would it take to make a successful Montgomery bus boycott? What percentage would be needed? How much profit margin would be impacted over how many weeks to months? Like that level of calculating how to hit them at vulnerable spots. So Practical Radicals is a really interesting book and podcast, just, you know, as a plug, just as your podcast is, of like the tools that we need to come together, build that solidarity, but also like what has worked in the past and what should we do? So it's almost like this evidence-based activism that I know, like my tendency is like, I can go on a march and stuff, which makes me feel great. And I go home and I'm all proud and I'll post my photos on whatever social media to show how good I am. But what has been demonstrated to actually move the needle? You know, and I have to say the young people of this country are coming up with such brilliant solutions. I mean, for example, the ICE hotline across the country and just having it flooded with people reporting Elon Musk as being an undocumented immigrant, which he was, by the way, but like creative challenges to that. But also, I think ideas, getting ideas out there of not just a reaction to the bad that we're seeing in this moment that has come and gone over 400 years, you know, but what's our utopian vision? What is the positive ideal we want to create together? What can we create as a community of human beings, you know, in this society where we should be able to not worry about healthcare or education and the reverse, trust in the system that our human potential will be fully developed and not because the public school is underfunded because it's in a poor neighborhood versus in a rich neighborhood, the reverse, you know, making sure that all of our citizens and non-citizens, all of the literal human beings, you know, we have here in this country have the rich opportunity to develop that human potential so we can all learn from the genius we have within that we can contribute together in society.
You've given us so much to think about, and there's about six of your papers we haven't even touched on. So we definitely need you back for another episode. Thank you so much.
It would be a true honor. And then I can interview all of you. I want to know about your amazing work, but it's a true honor. And the work that you're doing with this podcast, like you could be doing so many other things, right? On a Friday morning and stuff, but your dedication to doing this and building your, you know, this micro community, turning into a macro community, reaching your listeners, this is all such important work. So thank you to all of you for doing this. And you too, Elizabeth, silent one, working behind the scenes. So I appreciate your work as well. We can do it. All together, we can do it. Thank you to all of you.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on bioethics in the margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.